Taking our Bibles this evening, turn once again to the 90th Psalm. The 90th Psalm. Last week, we broke ground on a new series of sermons and lessons and messages and such dealing with church history. I've entitled this new series, Church History, A Timeline of the Sacred Past. And last week, we basically broke ground by introducing the subject matter. So with that, I would like to refresh ourselves by one of the texts that we looked at. Please turn to the 90th Psalm and look at verses 9 and following. For all of our days are passed away in thy wrath. We spend our years as a tale that is told. The days of our years are 80 years, and if by reason of strength they be 80 years, yet in their strength labor and sorrow, for it is soon cut off, and we fly away. Who knoweth the power of thine anger? Even according to thy fear, so is thy wrath. So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. For the past couple of days, as I drive to and from the location where I am currently working, I pass by a local cemetery. And just outside the fence line of this cemetery, which is a historical landmark to this city, the name of the cemetery has been chiseled on a chunk of rock. And then right below the name of this historic cemetery here in town is chiseled the following quote. Here, history has lived since 1859. And I got to pass by that rock every day. And it just stuck in my mind as we've now broken ground on the subject of church history. And this is true. All those people that are buried in that cemetery, once again, that little quaint saying, here, history, or where history has lived since 1859. Everybody that's buried in that cemetery was part of the history of this city. In all likelihood, there may be some very prominent people buried in that ground, movers and shakers that made Topeka what it is. In the past, and maybe in its recent past. Well, beloved, last week we broke ground once again on church history. And as I told you before, my aim is to do basically an overview of church history. And we're about to begin the first century. And so this evening's lesson is entitled The Apostolic Era, 30 AD to 100 AD. And the first thing that I want to present is a three-part lesson, part one today, and that is the backdrop of the context of the apostolic age. And we're going to consider three important factors that basically laid the groundwork and set the stage, set the context for the coming of the Messiah. And those three contexts is going to be the impact of the Greek culture, secondly, the impact of the contribution made by the Roman culture, that is the Roman Empire. And then the third and final lesson on this, basically this backdrop, is the contribution or the impact of Jewish culture. And so with that in mind, I want to break ground here this evening and present to you what was the impact of the Greek Empire by the time Jesus comes on the scene. Jesus appoints his 12 disciples, his apostles, as the foundation to the church. And when the church is let loose in Acts chapter 2 with the filling of the Spirit, as we've seen in our journey through Acts, what was the world like? What was the context of the world? When the apostles went out through Asia Minor and they went to Philippi and Thessalonica, when Paul goes to Athens and when Paul finally gets to Corinth, what was the world like? What was the setting in which the gospel came? Well, beloved, when it comes to the Greek culture, I think everybody automatically, when you say Greek Empire, I believe everybody's mind will home in on one central figure of Greek culture, and that is Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great lived from 356 BC to roughly 323 BC. He was a very young man when he became the leader of his own city-state, Macedonia. His father, Philip, basically lays the foundation for Alexander to come on the scene in the sense of rising to prominence. And then Alexander unites all the separate Greek states and he forms this Greek empire. And then lo and behold, those of us who can remember, as we've been studying the book of Esther, at least the first chapter, the main obstacle to Alexander's expansion was this roadblock to his east, and that was the Persian Empire. Well, in a very brief time, in a short amount of time, Alexander unites all of the Greek independent city-states, and then he launches his attack against the Persians. And in a short amount of time, he subdues the Persians. And history tells us that Alexander goes all the way to India. He even made inroads into what we would call today parts of southwest China, possibly Mongolia. And when he comes to the Indus River, he sits down and cries, according to history. And he cries because there's no more land to conquer. And his soldiers were waging war for 8 or 10 consecutive years. They were away from their families and from their children. And as time went on, they got weary of fighting. And they were pleading with Alexander to go back home. You've conquered all of the known world. And that got Alexander very upset. Well, several things happened to Alexander. One of them was his homosexual boyfriend dies, believe it or not. He was a person who dabbled in homosexual behavior. And Alexander mourns the death of this close male companion of his. And that basically starts Alexander's skid, if you will, into self-destruction. He began to indulge in a lot of revelry, especially in the consumption of alcohol. And lo and behold, Alexander's mind began to turn to oatmeal. He comes down, he contracts an illness, and that basically forces the issue. He goes all the way back to Alexandria, Egypt. He dies, and that is where I believe he ended up being buried. And then his empire now, he had no son, and so you have this squabbling amongst his generals, and four generals basically take the entire Greek empire and divide it into four pieces of pie, if you will. And then that begins to move historically towards the end of the Old Testament period. But I want to show you some stuff from the scriptures whereby we can actually point to Alexander the Great right from the pages of Holy Scripture. Turn to Daniel chapter 2. Daniel, the second chapter. Let me show you some information that might be quite familiar with some of you, if you're familiar with the book of Daniel. Now, there are two different opinions about the book of Daniel. Those who take the book of Daniel to be the Word of God, supernaturally inspired by the Spirit of God, we accept the traditional dating of this book into the 6th century B.C. But there are those who call themselves skeptics and critics. They will tell us that they believe that the book of Daniel was possibly written in the 3rd and the 2nd century, whereby Daniel loses its entire prophetic punch and basically is boiled down to simply as a writing of a man named Daniel looking back to everything as history. Well, beloved, we take the more biblical view that Daniel wrote this in the time frame in which he lived, around 600 BC, and that much of what he writes not only as a historical figure in his own context, but he also writes, guided by the Spirit, looking prophetically into the very near future for him as well as for us. Look at Daniel chapter 2, and look at verses 39. Daniel chapter 2. In verse 39. Here the prophet Daniel is beginning to interpret this dream that the king had. And the king sees four different beasts. He sees this metallic man with a head of gold, the chest and the arms of silver, the waist area as bronze, two legs of iron, and then the feet and the toes of iron and clay that were mingled. Well, the head of gold represented King Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian Empire. And so now Daniel tells the king, "And after thee, Nebuchadnezzar, and Babylon, shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth." The pronoun thee refers to Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian Empire that was in vogue at the time, that was in sway. The second kingdom, the kingdom that should be inferior to thee, was actually the Persians. And the reference to the third kingdom of brass, mentioned in verse 39, points to Alexander the Great and the Greek Empire. The Greek Empire. Then look at verse 40. "And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh all these shall it break in pieces and bruise." Verse 40 denotes the Roman Empire. So here is Daniel living on the scene around 606 BC. He was a member of the royal family. He is part of that royal family, that royal entourage that was eventually taken by Nebuchadnezzar and transferred back to Babylon, where the king gives Daniel and his three friends names that were actually names of Nebuchadnezzar's gods. He tries to erase their Jewish identity. He tries to eradicate their Jewish upbringing. And King Nebuchadnezzar does this by giving them new names. These names were actually the names of Babylonian deities. While he has this dream, the king does, in chapter 2, and he sees this metallic man. And no one is able to decipher the actual meaning of this image. Well, Daniel comes into the king's palace, and he begins to decipher what these metals represent. And so I offer to you, in verse 39, the word thee, Babylon. The second kingdom, which would be inferior, would be the Persians. This third kingdom of brass refers to the Greeks. And then in verse 40 is the reference to the Roman Empire. Now turn to Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7. Now, in chapter 7, Daniel sees a vision. But in this vision, God portrays the same kingdoms, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome, not as a metallic man, but as beasts, denoting their sinful, carnivorous nature. Look at verses 6. "After this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it." Well, my dear friend, verse 6 denotes the Greek Empire. Now look at verse 4. "And the first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. And I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth, and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it." This reference to the lion standing up and a man's heart being given to it, many feel, is a reference to Nebuchadnezzar. Remember when he was smitten, and he went around walking on fours like an animal for a period of 7 years, and then finally he was restored. And you find that in Daniel chapter 4, where I believe is actually a statement of King Nebuchadnezzar's conversion. Well, many feel that the reference to the lion standing as a man and a man's heart being given to the lion refers to Nebuchadnezzar's experience mentioned in Daniel chapter 4. But verse 4 here denotes Babylon. Look at verse 5. And behold another beast, a second like a bear, and it is raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in its mouth of it, between the teeth of it, and they said unto it, Arise, devour much flesh. Verse 5 denotes the Persian Empire. And these three ribs denotes, when you check out ancient history, these three ribs were actually three prominent geographical peoples or locations that the Persians were able to gobble up as they expanded. And so the Persians are denoted as this lumbering bear that lays on one side. Do you notice how even here you see this inferiority? You go from a lion now to a bear. Now in verses 6, you have this leopard. Do you see the reference to the four wings and to the four heads? Many commentators point to this and say that the four heads and the four wings is pointing to the fact that when Alexander the Great did die, and since he had no male children to move into the spot of being king, his empire was divvied up by four of his generals. Four of his generals. And then in verses 7, has a reference to the Roman Empire. So you take Daniel chapter 2, okay, and this is an image that God gives to Nebuchadnezzar in a dream. And do you see a difference here? When God deals with a pagan man, how does God represent these kingdoms? He represents them as man sees himself, a proud, boastful image of this metallic man, what a head of gold, and then the silver, and the brass, and the iron. But when God gives the same vision to Daniel in chapter 7, to a saved man, he denotes the same four empires, but he reveals their spiritual depravity by likening them to an animal, or to a beast. And most people don't see that. Daniel 2 is an image that the king sees that he can relate to. But in Daniel 7, God gives the same dream only to his prophet, and he doesn't present man in all of his glory. How does he present the kingdoms of men? As ravenous beasts. I found that amazing. Now turn to Daniel chapter 8. What I'm showing you, my dear friends, that this is all prophecy. This is all showing you Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. And right now we're looking at the first impact, or the first contributors to the first century groundwork, and that is the Greeks. Look at Daniel chapter 8, verses 1 to 8. Now, God gets very specific. He gets very specific, and he's going to use animals once again. And he's going to show human history. But now he's going to center his attention between the Persians and the Greeks. And I'm going to show you where Alexander the Great is actually prophesied. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, Daniel, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. And I believe that has reference to chapter 7. And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was in Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in my vision, and I was by the river Eulate. Then I lifted up my eyes, and saw, and behold, there stood stood before the river a ram which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. Now what in the world does that mean? Well, here's the interpretation. The ram represents Persia. The two horns represents the two peoples that comprised the Medo-Persian Empire. You had two classifications of people, the Medes and the Persians. Okay? But did you notice that one horn grows higher and supersedes the other horn? Well, history tells us that when the Medes and the Persians combined, in the course of a short period of time, the Persian element of that empire became more dominant than the Medes. Verse 4. And I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward. So verses 4a shows the expansion of the Persian Empire. So that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. So verses 4, friends, is showing the expansion and the pushing of the Persian Empire, which, beloved, did gobble up the Babylonian Empire first, and then begins to spread. And as I was considering, behold, a he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth. Well, beloved, if you look at a map, west of the Persian Empire, you come in contact with the Greeks. Greeks. And the ram here, this goat is Alexander. Alexander. He touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Do you see the phrase where it says that this goat did not even touch the ground? This is language denoting the speed in which Alexander would ultimately conquer what he would know as his own known world. The goat doesn't even hit the ground. The goat just simply goes and makes no contact with the ground, denoting the speed and the swiftness in which the Greeks would overrun the Persians. Beloved, the Greek Empire included parts of southern Italy, all of the Greek peninsula, all of Asia Minor, all of Persia, all the way to India, and all the way through North Africa, Palestine to include what is now today Libya and Egypt, and possibly into Ethiopia as you follow the Nile River. That's a chunk of real estate. The Persian Empire was very, very vast. Well, in verse 5 here, the goat Alexander comes to attack. Verse 6. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler against him, and smote the ram, and broke his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to stand before him, Alexander. But he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And for it came up four notable ones towards the four winds of heaven. So, beloved, this notable horn, this great horn of verse 8 is Alexander the Great. And then we're told that four notable ones come up. That would be the four surviving generals of Alexander who divvied up his empire upon his death. So, Daniel chapter 7, verse 6, cross-references very beautifully with Daniel chapter 8, verses 1 to 8. But in Daniel chapter 8, God gives a prophetic close-up between the empires of Persia and Greece. Now, I'm saying all this because I'm leading up to something. Now turn to Daniel chapter 8, verses 20. Turn to Daniel chapter 8 and verses 20. Now, as I mentioned last week, when you come to history, you're going to deal with names, dates, and events. And for some people, that's very boring and very dry. You need to discipline as well as me as we plow through this, because, beloved, we're reading the Scripture. And we're trying to decipher this for your good and for your understanding. Look at verses 20 to 22. In case you think I was pulling your leg, the ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. And the rough goat is the king of Grecia. And the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now, that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. So there, my friend, I give to you the Bible's own commentary on the events found in Daniel 8, verses 1 to 8. The Bible tells you who these animals are. All I'm doing is deciphering it for you to lay down some foundation. Now, turn finally to Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 11. The entire chapter 11 of Daniel is nothing more but an unfolding of prophetic history as it would relate to Daniel and Daniel's people. Okay? Look at verses 1 to 4. Also I, in the first year of Darius, notice, what's it say? The Mede. Not Darius the Persian, but the Mede. And I told you that in Persia you had two peoples, the Medes and the Persians, come together to form up another empire. And they whoop up on the Babylonians. But in time, the predominance of the Persians would outweigh the Medes. And then it's known as the Persian Empire. It begins as the Medo-Persian. And then eventually we get down to the book of Esther with King Artaxerxes and all of those guys. It's called the Persian Empire because the influence of the Persians dominates over the Medes. Also I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I, stood to confirm and to strengthen him. And now I will show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia. By the time Daniel is writing this, listen to this. Daniel was able to see the rise and the fall of the Persian Empire. The rise and fall of the Babylonians. And he's going to live to be old enough to witness the rise of the Persians before he dies. But now God is showing him, shortly after you die, Daniel, there's going to be three main Persian kings on the scene of history. And one of them is going to be Xerxes. These kings that we meet up in the book of Esther, in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, these are the kings that are being referred to. And now I will show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. Many feel that this fourth one, the one that's really rich, and the one who tries to really crush the Greeks, is Artaxerxes, the one that you find in the book of Nehemiah. The cupbearer, Nehemiah, the king that he served, which was Artaxerxes, and it's this fourth king that is being referred to. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up against the realm of the Greeks. And a mighty king shall stand up, Alexander, and shall rule with great dominance and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided towards what? The four winds of heaven. So the four winds of heaven in verse 4 here cross-references back to those four notable ones back in Daniel chapter 8 verse 22. And not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others besides those. Now why have I said all this? When Alexander the Great enters Palestine, as he begins to conquer the Greeks into one nation, he crosses over into the country that we know today as Turkey. Back then, Asia Minor. And that was the furthest west of the Persian Empire, was Asia Minor. He has two major battles whereby he wins and conquers the Persians. Before he decides to go straight east, he realizes that he has to go south and he has to conquer Egypt. Well, to get to Egypt, guess where he has to cross? He has to go right down Palestine. He has to walk right into the very domain of God's ethnic ancient people. And when he comes into Jerusalem, this is history. Do you know what the high priest does? The high priest holds a copy of the Old Testament scrolls, and guess what they tell Alexander? We've been waiting for you. We knew you were coming. And he looks at them and says, how? And they opened up the book of Daniel, and they opened up these verses I just gave you, and they revealed to Alexander that this is you, this is you, and this is you as recorded in our scriptures. And guess what Alexander does to God's people? He treats them with kid gloves, and he allows them to practice their faith unhindered by the Greeks. That's why I said all this, to say that. They held up the scrolls and says, we knew you were coming. And by the way, Daniel told us about you. You're mentioned here, and you're mentioned here, and you're mentioned here. And Alexander is pleased. He kind of inflates his ego. And then he goes off and whoops up on the Egyptians and crowns himself Pharaoh, marries an Egyptian woman to tie the knot, and he assumes the title of Pharaoh. Then with his southern flank done, guess what he does? He goes back and whoops up on the Persians and eventually spends 10 more years whooping up all the way to India and into Mongolia. But God's ancient people were able to hold up the scrolls and tell him, we knew you were coming. You're right here. This is talking about you. And he kind of liked that. And he let them live in tranquility. And he didn't harm them. And he gave them the freedom to worship without his interference. Well, one more thing about Daniel 11. Do you see verses 5? From verses 5 all the way to the end, to verse 45, do you know what you have prophetically given? When Alexander dies, his empire is divided into four sections. Two of those key sections would play a pivotal role in Israel's history. And you know what they are? I want you to put a map in your head. Today, you hear the country of Syria, don't you? Syria, which is north of the modern-day country of Israel. Syria. Well, that was called the Seleucid Empire, named after General Seleucid, who took up one of the four chunks of Alexander's empire. So here's Syria. Here's Palestine, God's people. Well, to the south of God's people, what do you find? Egypt. And guess which general took up Egypt? General Ptolemy. So you have the Seleucids to the north, modern-day Syria. And to the south, you have what's called the Ptolemaic dynasty. And in between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies was Israel. Guess what, friends? Before Daniel died, and before Alexander was even on the scene, verses 5 to verse 45 of chapter 11 is nothing more but God describing to Daniel the awful history, the awful events that God's people would experience in the 3rd, 2nd, and the 1st century B.C. before the arrival of Christ. And what do you find in verses 5 to 45? You're going to find that the Seleucid Empire to the north and the Ptolemaic Empire to the south, each of these empires would try to conquer the other. To do so, what did they have to do? They had to go through the promised land, back and forth. And there were times and seasons when the Seleucians would get the upper hand, conquer Palestine, and then invade Egypt. Then a Ptolemaic king would come on the scene, rally the Egyptians, and they would fight the Seleucians. But to do so, whose backyard did they have to plow? Ancient ethnic Israel. Back and forth, back and forth. And beloved, verses 5 to 45 of chapter 11 is nothing more but prehistory of those events of the 3rd, 2nd, and 1st century B.C. before the birth of Christ in Bethlehem. I forget the verse, but one of the verses in those verses is a reference to Cleopatra. She was a daughter of a Ptolemaic king. She's found in these verses as well. Well, I've given you basically the Old Testament picture of the Greek Empire that was to come into play. Well, as we begin to wind down, the question is this. What was the contribution of the Greeks? What impact did they give to us? Why are they so important when Christ comes on the scene and when the apostles begin to spread the gospel? Listen to this. One of the crowning contributions made by Alexander the Great was the fact that he gave to the known world a standard language of Koine Greek. When Alexander would begin to conquer, one of the things that Alexander did that made people actually like him is when he conquered someone. Now, if you were wise enough to put the white flag up, fine. But if you were dumb enough to go against Alexander, he would basically decimate the entire city. Many cities in Persia, as he was conquering, they just simply opened the gate, threw the flags up. And what he would normally do, the king who put the flag up, Alexander, would normally marry his daughter, cement the contract. That king became his vassal, and Alexander kept on plowing to the east because he knew his west backside was covered because he had all these marriage contracts made, just in name only. He would marry these people, but he also had his gay lover, but he would marry these women to sign these, to solidify these contracts between these vassal kings or these vassal empires, and they basically gave him whatever he needed, and they covered his western backside, if you will, as he kept on plowing to the east. Well, as he began to amalgamate these people, they all spoke different languages. And if he gave a command in his own language, only a small section of his army would move. Everybody else would just be looking around. So Alexander comes up what we call is Koine Greek, common Greek, street Greek, if you will. And he made it a requirement that everybody in his realm would know that language. They would know their mother tongue, but they had to learn this form of the Greek language. And it was universal. So my dear friends, when you come to the New Testament, except for only a few portions that may have been written in the Aramaic, the overwhelming majority of your Greek New Testament, upon which your New Testament is based, was written in the Greek that Alexander left behind. Because it was the universal tongue, like English is today, as Latin used to be, and as Greek once was. And so by the time Jesus comes on the scene, there is this universal language that is in place. Beloved, that made the gospel, or the preaching of the gospel, so simple, so easy. Because everyone, even the Jews who lived outside of Palestine, especially who were forced to do business with the Gentile dogs, were forced to learn that Greek in order to conduct business with the Gentiles. It was a universal language. The Greeks also gave us the concept of independent city-states. We get our form of democracy from the Greeks. The Greeks were the ones who came up with this limited view of democracy. And again, because of how they thought and how they put it into play, it was normally the males who ran the government. Greek women were not involved in politics. The slaves had nothing to say about how things ran. But you would have the city fathers of a given city-state, and they would conduct the business, and they call that city a polis. And we get our word politics from the concept of the Greek polis, of the independent Greek city-state. The Greeks were lovers of philosophy. What does Paul say? The Jews require a sign, but the Greeks demand what? Wisdom. We have three great philosophers. These names are like household names. Plato, Socrates, and Aristotle. Do you realize that the writings of Plato were still influencing the Roman Catholic Church by the time Galileo was able to make his telescope? And when Galileo began to look out that telescope, he began to put one and one together, and there were other men at that time connecting the dots, and they realized that the Earth was not the center of the universe, but that the Sun was the center of the universe, and the planets went around the Sun. Do you know that at one time people were burned at the stake by the Catholic Church? Because the Catholic Church at one time believed in a worldview based on Plato. Not based on Bible. Well, it was based on Greek philosophy. Those of you who see pictures of Washington, D.C., you have to admit that even to this day, Greek culture affects us today by the very architecture of our own buildings, even in Washington, D.C. There's even some buildings here in town. If you go downtown Topeka, you will find certain styles of architecture that still smack of a Greek flavor. Well, beloved, the Greeks also had their gods. The Greeks were believers in many gods. And every city in all these city-states had their patriot god. One particular god that was revered or looked up to. But the main god of the Greeks was the god Zeus. The god Zeus. While the Romans called him Jupiter, the Greeks called him Zeus. He was the head god who lived in Mount Olympus. Here's another contribution of the Greeks. Where do you think we get the Olympic Games? It's from the Greeks. And beloved, when you read, as we shall see here hopefully in a few weeks, possibly a month or so, in our journey in sanctification, Paul likens the Christian life to an athletic race, that Paul was able to take that imagery that everybody who read that in the scriptures could point their finger to the Olympic Games that were held, where athletes went out there and they strove for the mastery. They strove to get that olive branch thing on their head as a trophy, like today's Olympic guys and gals trying to earn a gold medal. Well, back then they would put a wreath around your head, an olive wreath. And that was the climax. That was first place. Well, what do you think Paul gets the image of the Christian life being as a race? And we are to strive to gain the mastery. And we are to be temperate in self-control. We're to bring our body and its sinful passions in check. Where did Paul get that image? From the Greeks. Well, turn to Acts chapter 17. By the time Paul reaches the city of Athens, he is going to be confronted by Greek culture. Let me show you something. There's some people mentioned here in Acts 17. Acts chapter 17, look at verses 17 to 21 first. Acts 17, look at verses 18 to 21. Then certain philosophers of the Epicureans and of the Stoics encountered him, Paul, and said, "What will this babbler say?" Others, he seemeth to be a setter forth of strange gods, because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection. And they took Paul, and they brought him into the Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new doctrine whereof thou speakest is? For thou bringest certain strange things to our ears. We would know, therefore, what these things mean." And watch this parenthesis. "For all the Athenians," the Greeks, "and strangers which were there at the Areopagus, spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing." Do you see the reference to the Epicureans and to the Stoics? My dear friend, listen to this. When Paul reaches the city of Athens, you're looking at roughly the 50 AD time frame, 52, 53 AD time frame. The Epicureans and the Stoics, you know how far back they go? To the 4th century BC. So even though Paul is on the scene now in the middle of the 1st century, two predominant Greek philosophical systems are still on the scene. And beloved, listen to me. The Church of Jesus Christ in the 1st century had to deal with these two philosophies. And I got some bad news. These two philosophies are here today. Maybe under a different name, but they're still here. Now you may be asking, well, what are they? The Epicureans. You know who the Epicureans were? Listen to this. The Epicureans believed that the main thing in life was to reach a peaceful state of mind. The Epicureans' aim of life was pleasure. The highest pleasure was the absence of pain. Pleasure of the mind was preferable to that of the body. To an Epicurean, the soul dies with the body, so we must not fear death or the afterlife. The gods, plural, exist, but do not concern themselves with humanity or natural phenomena. Do we have people today who think that way? We get Epicureans all over this city, and we have Epicureans all over this country. These people took the mentality, eat, drink, and be merry. Eat, drink, and be merry. And one of the things that the Epicureans really liked to indulge, they loved food. They were connoisseurs of food. And so to them, the biggest aim in life was simply peace of mind. No worries, no concerns. Eat, drink, and be happy. Well, guess what? Guess who the Stoics were? The Stoics were a 180 degree reversal against the Epicureans. The Stoics believed in total self-denial. They outright rejected the Epicureans. They did believe in some so-called mystical supernatural being, but they didn't give it a name. And they believed that passion and all desire was evil. I want you to kind of get this. All passion and all desire were evil. By the time you hit the 2nd and 3rd century, you begin to find the early beginnings of Christian monasticism. And you had these Christians who believed, well, the world's going to hell in a handbasket, and I don't want to get involved, and I want to be so sanctified, I'm going to separate myself from the world, and I'm going to either hide in the cave or sit on a pole and just wait for Jesus, and society be damned. Where do you think the Christian monks in this monasticism and this asceticism? And then eventually, what does Paul warn us? Someone come on the scene saying that even marriage is evil. Well, beloved, the sexual drive between a man and a woman under the veil of matrimony is good. That's where God intended it to be played out. But the Stoics said all passion was evil. Even the passion between a man and a woman. And so lo and behold, by the 2nd and 3rd century, this Greek Stoic influence comes into the church, and there were people who were fabricating a false external form of sanctification that God never blessed. What else did Paul warn us? Some would even tell you to abstain from meats. Well, that mentality, my dear friend, comes from the Greek Stoics. And when you come to the Alexandrian school of interpretation, where men like Alexandrius and men like Origen, they try to harmonize Plato's Greek philosophy with New Testament scripture and try to blend the two in order to teach and to interpret Christian theology. And in the pursuit of doing that, they came up with some of the off-wall conclusions. Like I told you before, Origen reads Matthew, I believe Matthew 10, where Jesus tells people to pluck out eyes, chop off your limbs in order to mortify yourself. Origen took that so literally, he castrates himself, thinking that would curb his sexual drive. And then later on the road, he becries what he's done to himself. But it's too late then to start a family. All that, my friend, is part of Christian history. And it was nothing more but a misinterpretation and a misuse of the scripture being twisted with Greek philosophy. Now, I said all that to say this. Turn now. Well, let me first finish here. Read on now, Acts 17. Look at verses 22. The Greeks were lovers of philosophy, Plato, Socrates, and Aristotle. And you have these two camps, the Epicureans and the Stoics. Well, look at Acts 17 as Paul begins to preach to these people. Then Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill and said, "Ye men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are what? I perceive that in all things you are superstitious." The word there means religious. "As I passed by and beheld your devotions, I found an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God, whom therefore ye ignorantly worship, him declare I unto you.'" So here's proof that when Paul gets to Athens, and beloved, Athens was a university town. Athens, there was two major cities in Greece. Athens and Sparta. The Athenians loved philosophy, and they built this great academy. To the south of them was the city of Sparta. And beloved, the Spartans were tough, they were stoic, they were disciplined, they would take their young male boys away from mom and dad at the age of 7 years old, 6 or 7 years old, and immediately threw them into a military boot camp where the child could never see his mom or dad again. And the training of these children was brutal. At the age of 6 and 7, they were put into an arena with an older kid, maybe a teenager, and they were bullied, they were beat, they were starved, and they would be given military-type maneuver exercises where they threw them out in the wilderness and they had to fend for their own food. And when they cried because of the hardship at 7, they were beat. And they were beat until that person became nothing more to the equivalent of a United States Marine, if you will. All they were was a killing machine. And so you have these two centers, the Athenians and then the Spartans. And here the Apostle Paul makes reference to the fact while in Athens, he sees all their devotions and all their temples, and he tells them, "You're too religious, you're too superstitious," and now Paul comes to preach unto them the true God. Now turn to Colossians chapter 2. I made that reference about philosophy to show you this one. Turn to Colossians chapter 2. Colossians chapter 2, and notice this warning by the Apostle Paul. Colossians chapter 2, look at verses 8 and 9, friends. Paul says, "Beware lest any man spoil you through philosophy and vain deceit, after the tradition of men, after the rudiments or the principles of the world, and not after Christ. For in him dwelleth all the fullness of the Godhead bodily. And ye are complete in him, which is the head of all principality and power." So yes, my friends, the Greeks gave us a whole lot. Matter of fact, according to some of the stuff that I read, all of Western culture, all of Western culture is basically built upon the philosophy of Greek philosophy. Men like Plato, Aristotle, and Socrates, their writings, their ideas, forms the basis of what we call today Western civilization. And when the Romans, who will be our next people that we'll study next week, when the Romans eventually conquered the Greeks, you know what the Romans do? They don't believe in reinventing the wheel. They took the Greeks, they took their philosophy, they took their gods, they took their architecture, they borrowed it and improvised it and put it to use. When the Romans conquered the Greeks, they do not decimate the Greeks. Matter of fact, if you were a Roman living in the first century and you wanted your child to be homeschooled, you know what you did? You went down to the slave block and you found yourself a Greek teacher, a tutor, and you would pay good money and take that Greek home, and that Greek tutor became that child's teacher, especially for the boys, until that boy was able to reach manhood. The Romans would buy Greek teachers and bring them to Rome to tutor their own children. But again, the overarching contribution that sets the stage for Christ with regards to Alexander and the Greeks was this universal language that comes on the scene. And it's that universal language that becomes the foundation upon the Greek New Testament text that we hold in our hand as it is translated in the New Testament in our authorized version. Well, may God bless the Word, and may that little lesson of history just be enough to tantalize your appetite. But again, friends, don't forget these two schools, the Epicureans and the Stoics. They may be by a different name, but they walk the streets of our fair city. Eat, drink, and be merry. And then you have this pseudo-self-denying religion that looks very nice on the outside, but it's really empty and hollow on the inside. Amen.